Hello, heroes, and welcome to Session Zero, a podcast exploring role-playing through a psychological perspective. I'm Steve Discont.
And I'm Porter Green.
And today we'll be discussing colonialism.
Hey, heroes. Gen Con is right around the corner, and we'll be doing a panel there this year. We are scheduled for Thursday, August 1st at 3 o'clock p.m., where we will be exploring the mental health depictions at the table.
Aaron Catano-Saez and Adira Slattery from the One Shot Network will be helping us teach everyone how to roleplay mental illness in a non-problematic way. The event may be sold out in the system, but we encourage you to still come by just in case there are any last-minute open seats.
See you there!
Welcome back for part two of colonialism.
Welcome back.
Steve, do you want to introduce our guest?
Sure. So if you haven't listened to our previous episode, we have a special guest today. That special guest is James Mendez-Hodes.
What's good? Glad to be here again.
If you haven't listened to last week's episode, maybe go back and catch it because it's really where all the definition parts
of
what we're going to be talking about today is.
Might be a good idea. That's where we, you might refer to it as our literature review section. If you're familiar with reading any psychology articles, and if not, that's totally cool. You don't have to have. You're here to learn.
Yeah.
Or just hear Mendez talk, or us talk.
That's what we do here, talking.
Yeah.
I enjoy listening to myself talk. I do it often.
So where we left off last episode, we kind of were exploring this idea of what colonialism is, its presence within psychology. And now we kind of want to turn our lens towards where colonialism fits within gaming and within a lot of our understandings of modern fantasy and modern sci-fi.
Well, if you think about it, one of the sort of like sneaky tools of colonialism is that it impacts how we tell stories and the stories that we tell and shapes how we look at people from like our sort of cultural consciousness.
How so?
Well, if you tell a story where all of the bad guys have dark skin and slanted eyes and all of the good guys are tall and white skinned with blue eyes, you're saying certain things about certain groups of people.
Do they have blonde hair and pointed ears?
Sometimes.
Interesting.
I mean, hey, no, there's diversity. One of them is short.
Ooh, shortness. I mean, that is diversity, but...
Very different. Yes, colonialism definitely makes its way into gaming in lots of different ways. If we look at gaming's roots, Dungeons & Dragons, when it first appeared in the late 20th century, was drawing on an older tradition of gaming that went back to things like Prussian Kriegsspiel, which were these tabletop war games with little toy soldiers, which commanders like Helmuth Karl Bernhard Graf von Moltke in Prussia, who was a contemporary and rival of Bismarck, would use to train his officers. So this Kriegsspiel, this wargaming, was this major underpinning of the Prussian military machine and Prussian military theory. And so after Moltke the Elder died and was no longer able to tell Germany not to invade people.
Oh, Germany.
Which was, yeah. So Moltke was not really into invasions because he had this theory that that German sovereignty and German strength of character was coterminous with German borders. And he said that, you know, we can go and mess around with France, but ultimately we're never going to be at our full strength as German soldiers unless we're on our home turf. And everything else besides that is risky as hell. But Germany eventually forgot that and engineered some wars of colonial aggression, which followed exactly the pattern that Moltke the Elder had said that they would follow. But those ideas then turned into popular tabletop war games, which were played outside of the officer corps. And those were some of the games that influenced the games that Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax were playing when they first developed Chainmail and Dungeons & Dragons. So so they came out of this context, which was like, I wouldn't say Kriegsspiel was imperialist or colonialist necessarily, but it was definitely imperial adjacent. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at what early Dungeons & Dragons is all about, there's a lot of exploring uncharted regions, meeting the people who live there, who are intelligent people, but not as clearly human or civilized as you are, and killing them and taking their stuff. That happens a lot. It's not all of early D&D, but there's certainly a good deal of it.
Almost like there's a Western tradition of that?
Yeah, it kind of is. And, you know, this was just for fun, which I guess that says something, too, about how we think here in the West in terms of, like, what are we going to do for fun? I guess we're going to dehumanize people and beat them up and take their stuff. And that sounds like an awesome way to spend a Midwestern winter.
I mean, America learning from daddy.
Western tradition of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that I don't like D&D. D&D's fine sometimes.
Sure. Well, I mean, not to potentially shame like people who enjoy D&D, because there are, you know, mm-hmm. there are definitely people at this table who like their Dungeons and Dragons and Pathfinder.
For sure. I love D&D.
But I think it's important to also recognize where, like, even in the games that we play, there is that presence, that, I guess, mm-hmm. Eurocentric colonialist perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's actually the source of my own hesitation about D&D. It's not that I don't like the idea of what D&D is or the D&D experience as it's, you know, promised to me on the exciting blurb on the back of a book. But for some reason, and we might get into why a little bit later, I always seem to end up at the table with all the imperialists.
Hmm.
Hmm. Do you have any idea why? And I actually asked that, not even sarcastically. I'm like genuinely curious.
No. I think it's something that I wonder about. So partly it's that the people that I know and game with most often and with whom I jive with most easily when I'm playing games tend to like other games that emphasize different aspects of collaborative storytelling.
Mm.
And that's nothing against D&D. It just means that, like, we all happen to be really into, you know, Monster Hearts and Red Carnations on a Black Grave and Steelaway Jordan and abstruse Nordic LARPs where you cry in a corner for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I get that vibe.
For sure.
Yeah, and that's nothing against D&D, but it does mean that when I play D&D, it's more common that I'm playing it with strangers. And when I play it with random strangers, very often I run into people who seem really gleeful about the colonialist aspects and the violent aspects in a way that even I is like, and I think of myself as a man who enjoys violence. You know, I like Into the Badlands and martial arts and stuff, but I tend to run into these tables where there are people who give me pause. And that might just be a function of playing with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
But it has colored my emotional reaction to D&D.
Well, I think a possibility for that might be, you know, multiple times on our show, we've talked about schemas and our general understandings about like this idea of what D&D is. So I think part of that might be, and this is speculation, that part of it is that when people are coming together to play D&D, and it's not a group that, you know, you yourself are bringing together, what, you know, it might be strangers. A lot of people have a particular thing they expect out of the D&D experience.
Definitely.
And I think a lot of those are actually part of it. The going, killing an entire dungeon, taking the things, making yourself rich.
I mean, sure. Like, I think it also depends a lot on your context, right? Because, like, my D&D group is a long-running one. My wife is the DM. Everybody is queer and trans. And I can't think of the last time we went into a dungeon. Like, we just, like, one of the things my wife really sort of focuses on in her worlds is to do what she can to decolonialize things. And that's, like, a thing to sort of talk about with D&D is that a lot of us spend a lot of time fixing it. I think, Mendez, in your most recent article, there was actually some commentary on that. Like, why do we spend time fixing it instead of writing a new game that's not colonialist? But yeah, so, like, our context is, like, this kingdom that is struggling because of imperial things being enacted upon it. Another group of people that's recovering from genocide. And these two people trying to coexist to fight an imperialist kingdom.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the white sort of rich people in the area.
Definitely.
So it's a really different D&D than a lot of people would expect. Like, a couple of chapters ago, we saved an entire Null civilization and found out that a druid did a spell that gave them souls and allowed them to develop culture and then sort of threw it back to them. Like, how can we, do you guys want to have culture? Do you want to go back to going to your god? Like, how do you want this to go? And so it's a very different experience than.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I guess one of the things that I've noticed about D&D is sometimes I find that the D&D materials, and this is, you know, varied from edition to edition, but the materials often make it really easy to enact colonial acts, to apply this colonial pressure, just because there's lots and lots of rules for killing people and taking their stuff.
Mm.
For sure.
And I feel like I would have to hunt in the books a little bit more to find the revolutionary praxis aspect of it. Like, I could definitely run a violent revolution in D&D, but violence is, while, you know, Franz Fanon says it's a necessary part of decolonization, violence is only one of many, many, many things that are going on during a successful revolution. But beyond D&D, there's also, we were also talking before the podcast about how imperialism comes up in other genres of fantasy and fiction. Mm-hmm. We talked about, for example, in cyberpunk, Western cyberpunk often has this anxiety about the rise of economic and technological powers in the Far East, mm-hmm. which come from that late 20th century context of the quote unquote model minority, which is an awful idea, but there it is, mm-hmm. of Asian people getting economic power in the United States, the Japanese post-war economic miracle, and the rise of China as an imperial power, of Korea as a shipbuilding power, all of these issues of economic development in the Far East, which made the West feel threatened and which resurrected the fear of this stereotype called the Yellow Peril, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which was the idea that Asians are going to use treachery and deceit and underhanded tactics to overcome Western civilization and undermine it and replace it with their our own degenerate values, and then also steal white women. They always got to throw that one in there. They're going to steal the white women.
So I actually have a question for you, if you don't mind me jumping in.
Please do.
So with cyberpunk, it's interesting because I know some of the common themes that we purport are part of cyberpunk are things like, you know, recognizing what happens when capitalism may have gone way too far, looking at the benefits and also the risks of transhumanism. And I'm wondering where that sits in the context where we look at where cyberpunk can be colonialist.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack here, but I think one of the things that we should look at to start with is our understanding of what technology means. So there's different kinds of, you know, if we get a little bit philosophical about it, about our psychology, there's different kinds of reality. You know, there's religious reality and what you think is absolutely true because a religious authority or a religious text told you that it's absolutely true. There is social reality, things which are true because they're a social fact of your life. Like, even if your boss is wrong about everything, you still have to treat your boss as an authority because they're in a position of economic and social power over you. So there's that sense of social reality. And economists talk about economic reality and being able to boil everything down to stuff like market forces. But one of the forms of reality which Europe and the West have traditionally exalted over other forms of reality is scientific reality. Hmm. And this goes back to the European Enlightenment and the development of rationalism and humanism in the classic senses of those words, which is, I think, kind of a weird, it feels awkward to talk about because I think one of the linchpins of the scientific method is the fact that science does not involve itself in the business of absolute reality.
But scientists do, which is where the problem comes in. Mm-hmm.
Yes, many, many scientists do, especially the loudest ones. Mm-hmm. But the scientific method and the whole empirical idea is based on generalizing based on evidence that you've seen. And what that leads us to is not an absolute statement about reality. It's a statement that certain things can be verified through experimentation and observation. And science would not work if there were anything that was off limits. You're always allowed to like experiment and ask questions and doubt existing ideas, because when you do that and you do that experimentation and observation, the idea becomes stronger rather than weaker by the act of your doubt. And it's still possible to like do science in ways that are harmful and ask questions which we don't need to ask, you know, especially when those target vulnerable people. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other complex concept. How that
when science and colonialism intersect, you end up with some very horrible things.
Ooh.
Right.
That's kind of the short version of that conversation.
And this is one of the ideas that we sometimes see in cyberpunk, the idea that there is a scientific reality and a technological reality that is the most important reality. In cyberpunk, advanced technology and control of that technology tend to be identified with goodness and positivity and moving forward, which is kind of a departure from cyberpunk's like kind of original idea, like where if science fiction is about how technology might make our lives better, cyberpunk is often about how technology might make our lives worse, or it's supposed to be. But then very often in cyberpunk, we end up just fetishizing technology anyway, just in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at like the way people level up through games like Shadowrun, for example, it's sort of like you lose the punk. So it's not a bunch of street punks trying to fight against the man. It's a bunch of people progressively leveling up within the culture, getting more resources and forming their own organization to then shape the world around them, which is often very colonialist and oppressive.
Right. Yeah. So you're playing like the pigs from Animal Farm. And this has happened a lot. Like I've heard of so many cyberpunk, so many Shadowrun games which started out as like, yeah, we're a bunch of scrappy punks fighting back against the man. And then like, you know, you ask the same people what's going on a year later. And it's like, well, we all work for Aztechnology now.
Woof. That is literally the worst company you could work for people who don't know Shadowrun.
Well, that makes me think of, dang it, there's a game I'm trying to think of right now, which is literally, you're asking, you know, who wants to fight the man?
You're thinking of Misspent Youth.
Yeah, like Misspent Youth, where I think like that is actually one of the core conceits is like, if you're going to fight the power, what point are you going to become the power?
Exactly. And there's that mechanic in Misspent Youth of selling out to get a benefit in the moment, which holds you back in the long run. That isn't in all of cyberpunk because like sometimes you get a cyberpunk source book and you expect it's going to be all about, you know, punk resistance. And then you open it and it's just pages and pages and pages of pistol stats.
That, yeah.
Like every Shadowrun book.
Like every Shadowrun book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So bringing it, you know, we've been coming at this from a really high level. And so I'm kind of wanting to see it, you know, I want to bring this back to the gaming experience and the gaming table, especially so our heroes can know how they can apply some of, you know, the knowledge you might have taken from this. What are some things, Mendez, that you think would be really important for the heroes to consider when it comes to colonialism at their own tables?
Oh, that's a good question. So we're talking about from like a player perspective when we're going into a game, right?
So either a player perspective or a master ceremonies perspective.
Okay, interesting. So I guess to start with some of the RPGs that we've been talking about so far, you know, I feel like we've been throwing a lot of shade at D&D and Shadowrun. So we should definitely talk about how to push back against colonial and imperial ideas within those contexts. And I think that in those games, there are definitely going to be like pressure points where you're going to have to push against what exists in the game until it might break and you might have to change something. I guess one idea that I am pretty done with in gaming in general is the idea of there being evil races.
You were just about to ask about this.
Yeah, my wife was actually asking me when we were talking about this interview, how do you think that it's a good idea to construct evil in a game? Because I agree with you. I think evil races are vastly overly black and white and not useful.
Yeah, literally black and white very often. So I think that evil is meaningless unless it's a choice.
Total agreement.
If you have a supernatural power that's like, we'll talk about like kind of an easy one. The idea of an evil demon, like that's compelling, but it's also got limits because if a creature is made of pure evil and its whole decision-making process and free will is aligned towards evil, well, maybe it doesn't have free will, actually, and you're dealing with like what amounts to a complex automaton. Like a virus does really harmful things, and you know, there isn't a lot that influenza really does for us that's positive, but we don't refer to it as evil because the virus doesn't have an intellect that makes choices.
Outside of anthropomorphizing it, yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, so I'm wondering like, well, okay, if you have a demon, is that really a person? Is that really an intellect? Or is this like a really elaborate virus? But setting aside that idea, I think the idea of applying inherent evil to something like an orc or a goblin, that idea just does not fly with me at all. Because the way that we describe fantasy races in Tolkien and D&D and stuff, they're intelligent creatures who are much more like humans than they are unlike humans. And the idea that they are born evil, like, I'm going to, never mind whether it makes sense in the story or not. Like, I get it that it can make sense in the story that someone created a race that was pure evil, or a wizard cursed them, or they're all the victims of demons or whatever. Like, that stuff doesn't really matter to me as much as the fact that when you make these races inherently evil, it results in situations at the table where you act out racist and colonialist behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's really what matters to me. Like, you can go read my articles for, like, if you want to hear me opine about, like, whether Tolkien was a racist on purpose or not. But, like, all that stuff is actually much less important than the fact that when we're playing at the table, we should endeavor not to engage in colonialist behaviors without the enthusiastic consent of other people at the table.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, if everybody at the table has consciously agreed that, like, we're gonna, you know, explore colonialism in some context, then that's fine. But if some people at the table are like, hey, I just want, like, a fun fantasy adventure. And then other people are like, yeah, I want a fun fantasy adventure, and fun for me is like killing orc children.
Mm.
You end up with a disconnect, shall we say, between the two groups, because, like, maybe there's someone in one of those groups who's like, I think the way that you're talking about orcs makes me uncomfortable, because this is also the way that my oppressors talk about me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's, like, a cross minority experience of sort of associating with monsters, associating with the people that are traditionally othered, right?
Yeah. And like, if you're used to experiencing this kind of oppression in your life, you have what I refer to as a flinch reaction,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
This thing that goes on this subconscious level, on the same level where, like, unconscious bias and, like, your own racism live, where even if you know it's the DM, like, who's acting the part of a corrupt cop and is, like, oppressing and threatening you, and, like, they're acting the part of someone who's relying on a system of oppressive violence to keep you down, your
it's
reaction
still psychologically triggering.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Because, like, psychologically, we don't really distinguish strongly between pretending and things that are really going on in the
absolutely.
Moment.
Yeah.
Like, a really simple baseline thing you can do in your game to start to move away from that is to get rid of alignments.
Yeah.
Right. Like, get rid of the whole concept of alignment, or globally listing one thing as good and one thing as evil. Like, why is your enemy kobolds the race?
And I think that's something that, like, when you're looking at these ideas of values and mm-hmm. the things that motivate either characters or people, like, I, again, as someone who's heavily rooted in gaming, in urban fantasy, urban horror, New World of Darkness, as it was, used to use what were the seven virtues and the seven sins for determining, like, what are your character's motivations. But when they moved to Chronicles of Darkness, they entirely moved away from that, recognizing, well, one, that's really Western. Mm-hmm. It's very Abrahamic, and really specifically really Christian. But two, people are motivated by more things than just justice, prudence, or vices like sloth or
envy.
Thank you. Yes.
Sloth, lust.
Here I said just like waiting. Like, yeah, what are you talking about?
Sorry. I'm here, like, forgot the seven. I mean, I'm totally fine with forgetting the seven sins.
Oh, I was raised Catholic. I know all about this stuff.
Oh, me too.
But yeah, so in Scion, second edition, so Scion's a game about demigods. So everyone belongs to some pantheon or other in the world, and then you go have, like, super heroic American gods style adventures. In the first edition of Scion, every pantheon had four virtues that were associated with it. And the virtues were things like justice, honor, wisdom, knowledge. They were really generic.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, what pantheon doesn't value knowledge and strength, right?
Well, the war people, obviously.
Yeah, the war savages. They're not like us. In second edition, we moved away from that to every pantheon has these two virtues, which are in a state of tension that define a lot of their myths, that are major themes in their myths. And each of those virtue pairs is peculiar to the pantheon. So, like, the ones that I wrote for the Orisha of Yoruba land and the Vodun of Haiti and Dahomey, the virtues are tradition and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So tradition and innovation aren't, they're in tension. They don't oppose or cancel each other out necessarily. But in a lot of African myth, there exists this tension. And in African religion, there exists this tension between what's old and what's new, and what comes from Africa and what comes from the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
For the Devas of South Asia, the virtues that are at stake are conscience versus duty. Mm. Because there's this idea in Indian epics that you have this duty that you're given from stuff like the caste you're born into or the gods who you worship. Someone is handing this thing to you and they're telling you this is what you're meant to do. And in Indian epics, often we have all these characters who are set up with this duty and they follow this duty to its natural conclusion. And then it gets to a climactic point when suddenly it becomes clear that in order to do what's their duty, the characters have to commit an unconscionable act.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in the Mahabharata, that's like Arjuna shooting Karna in the back while he's fixing his chariot.
Mm, yeah.
Even though it
for sure.
It's against the rules. Or in the Ramayana, that's Rama throwing his wife out for the intimation that she might have hooked up with a guy who kidnapped her. So it gets to this point where like the hero is doing the dutiful thing, and then we as the reader are supposed to look at that and think, wait, what the hell?
Right. Yeah.
And
in psychology, we talk about like dialectics, right? Two opposing, equally strong, coexisting
exactly.
feelings or beliefs. And that's a wonderful thing to build your story on, because you, as a storyteller, you want your people sitting there hearing your story or taking part in it to feel that tension and to have to make complex moral decisions, because that's where the meat of the experience comes in, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the dialectic in the case of Sion, it's, to use the term we brought up in the first half of the podcast, it's emic. It comes from inside the culture and the culture's own perspective.
Mm-hmm. And you can, that emic-etic switch can also be a great tension point in the game. Like if you have your characters following the traditional sort of tropes of fantasy or tropes of cyberpunk, and they're put in a situation where those tropes are shown to be false, it gives everyone who's in that story a chance to sort of relate to the experience of going, oh, what I thought may not be true. And that's also a really useful way of looking at this when you're building your own stories.
Yeah. I guess one last thing that I want to talk about from within this D&D or Shadowrun context is I want to set aside the idea of unproblematic violence. I think that role-playing games are much more, like, never mind even just decolonized, I think they're more interesting when violence has consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know, it's fun for us to, like, swing axes and kill skeletons with spells or whatever, but I think if we want the story to be interesting, then violence has to have meaning and consequences. And when we start thinking about how violence fits into a story and how violence fits into culture, then we can start making, I think, responsible choices about it. And we can start aiming our characters such that the violence that they do is not colonial, but decolonial. Because Frantz Fanon says, violence is a necessary part of decolonization. You cannot have decolonization fighting against, you know, a violent imperialist structure without violence being on the table. So if we have to have violence in games because that's what people want out of D&D, and if we have to have violence in decolonization, then maybe if we put those two things together, then we can create something that's still scary and still exciting, but which ultimately is positive.
I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, I super agree with that.
So on that note, you know, we're looking at the time here and we realize we're coming to the end of our session. Mendez, is there anything you'd like to plug or anything that you'd like to promote while we have you?
Let's see. So first of all, in terms of other people's stuff, I think that there's a couple of RPGs out there which are really good about like this decolonized perspective, or which actually, you know, break down the process of colonialism into parts that help us learn about it. And I think the gold standard for me has always been Dog Eat Dog by Liam Lewanek Burke, which is an RPG that is explicitly about the interaction between colonists and natives, and is explicitly and like entirely about those interactions and how they make natives' lives more and more difficult and less and less dignified until they are forced into a position of violence. There's another thing called The Blue Way, which is by Jason Morningstar. And it's a weird little game, and I don't know when it's going to come out, or maybe it already has. I'm going to miss it. But it's about how a culture kind of erodes and falls apart under colonial pressure in reaction to acts of violence and exploitation.
Mm.
So I think those are really great for like having us like look at the process of colonialism. Then there's also another older game called Steal Away Jordan by Julia Ellingbow, where you play as slaves in the American South. And that game is really great for highlighting not just the obvious trauma and oppression of chattel slavery, but also for highlighting like the humanity and hopes and dreams and humor that characterize the lives of American slaves. And it's a really, really cool and challenging game to try to, you know, push a slave revolt in, because it mechanizes the systemic disadvantage that people who, you know, can't read, don't own land, and are, you know, the wrong color for having power in a country. It mechanizes all of those problems, but it also empowers people through, you know, cleverness and hard work to overcome some of those pressures. So yeah, and then in terms of my own work, I got a setting coming up for Fate soon. There's this Fate of Cthulhu game, which is about coming back from the future to prevent the ascent of the Elder Gods. Mm-hmm. And so I'm writing a piece that's about a zombie apocalypse. And the zombie apocalypse in this setting begins with the cultural appropriation of the Haitian concept of the zombie. Mm. So you're explicitly fighting back against cultural appropriation to prevent like this zombie apocalypse. And then later on this year, I've got a setting coming out for Hearts of Wulin, the Wuxia melodrama game. And it's actually a cyberpunk setting, which focuses on how traditional martial arts communities change and struggle when they come face to face with the internet and colonialism and cultural appropriation. And that setting's called Fight Me IRL.
That's awesome.
Nice.
Thank you. So yeah, hopefully you can I can get you your decolonization fix through those if I do really well.
Awesome.
We'll see.
And where can the heroes find you, Mendez?
Oh yeah. So my website is jamesmendezhodes.com. And if you go there, you're going to find all kinds of essays about stuff like historical gaming, gaming outside, playing as characters who aren't your own race, lots of complaining about orcs. And that's probably what you're most likely to have heard of me from at this point. So yeah, jamesmendezhodes.com to check out my blog. I also have a Patreon, patreon.com/MNDZ, which supports that blog. So that's the easiest way to make sure that I don't starve to death and therefore can continue writing articles.
Can people find you on Twitter?
Yes, I am on Twitter at Lula Vampiro. That's LulaVampiro. It's the Portuguese word for vampire squid.
Amazing.
Perfect.
Thank you.
So on that note, with all that in mind,
I guess I'll see you at the next session.
See you next session.
Peace.
If you've been enjoying Session Zero and other podcasts on our network, and you value independent creators being able to support themselves and continue to create content for you, consider supporting our network on Patreon at patreon.com/oneshotpodcast.
Your contributions to the One Shot Network helps us to pay for the studio that we record in, the content that we use to represent our work, the hosting of the podcast on the magic internet, and all the spicy water we consume. Becoming a contributor to the One Shot Network Patreon grants you access to bonus content in the network's secret archive, such as some of our personal gaming stories, and possibly some of your favorite network characters on our pretend therapy couch.
There are also other perks, like the Gift and Book Club, the T-shirt Club, and many more. Please consider contributing today.
Hey, heroes, looking for a new show to enjoy? Check out Asians Represent! Asians Represent celebrates Asian creators and diversity in the gaming community. Join the host Agatha Cheng and Daniel Kwan as they discuss gaming, genre, and representation with their guests and occasionally argue with each other to the sound of Agatha's beloved air horn app.
Heroes, we would love to hear from you and hear your ideas for our show. You can find us on Twitter at @SessionZeroPod, or you can email us at sessionzero@oneshotpodcast.com.
The song you hear right now is Hikari by I Love Brandon off his album Earth and Sky. If you would like to hear more of his work, visit eyelovebrandon.com or find him on Spotify, SoundCloud, Twitter, or wherever else you like to find your chill beats to listen to podcasts to.
Remember, heroes, Session Zero is for sharing information, not for therapy. If you feel like you need support, check out Psychology Today's Find a Therapist database. If you're experiencing a crisis, head into the emergency room or text CONNECT to 741-741 from anywhere in the USA. Be safe out there, and we'll see you in the next session.